So you want to optimize your Kafka cluster's latency, do you? Well, of course you do. Anna Povsner, an engineer on the Confluent Cloud team, joined me today to tell us how to measure latency and what processes contribute to the actual time it takes an event to move through Kafka end-to-end. I learned a lot from her. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am your host, Tim Berglund, and I'm joined again in the virtual studio by my friend and colleague, Anna Povsner. Anna is an engineer who spends most of her time working on performance optimizations for Kafka. Anna, welcome back.
Hi, team. Thank you for inviting me again.
You bet. Always a pleasure. I learn a lot when I have you on the show. So for completely selfish reasons, I want to make it happen as often as possible. You wanted to talk about multi-tenancy today. So that's really what we have in store. And multi-tenancy, there's a number of aspects to that. There's a heavy performance aspect to it. There's like some security implications, some API questions. There's all kinds of things. And it's a hot topic in as much as there are hot topics related to Kafka on social media. I mean, it's not, the Kafka community is a pretty well-behaved and kind place. It's not like people yell at each other on Twitter, but multi-tenancy is a thing that is being talked about right now. So I think it's a good thing to talk about. So kick us off. Why would anybody want multi-tenancy? What is it and why do we want it?
So obviously, right, like in Kafka, you can set, just deploy any application or many application on Kafka. It doesn't mean that you're actually multi-tenant. So what it means in reality is that's when you want to be able to isolate or protect your data or your application so that you can basically safely collocate, right, your data sets, applications. So I think I better to give like some examples for that. Like one case could be kind of a virtual cluster kind of scenario, right? So suppose you know, in your organization, you have like one team managing or setting up like one or just few Kafka clusters, and then you want just other teams just to be able to use them as if they all have their own without setting up a separate actual cluster, right? And so in that case, you really want to complete separation of data and applications. But in some cases, there are other cases where maybe it's really about that you want to deploy different applications, and sometimes they might want to be sharing data. So protecting, in a way, data is maybe not as important, but it's important to protect performance. Like, say you have like event-driven application that you're running, say like fraud detection, and they consume some data, and then you might want to run another application which uses some of the data that it produces to run some machine learning models. So in that case, you might want to share data but separate performance. And so, of course, there could be all kind of variations of both, you know, either or protecting either data or protecting your performance application, meaning that basically that when you use it as your cluster, you should be able to not be impacted of some other, you know, user or application, just whatever behavior, you know, can impact your own performance.
The second one sounds a lot harder to pull off, and I think we're going to get into that later on, but isolated with respect to performance, I mean, just running in the cloud as kind of everybody is going to, or at least on virtualized infrastructure of some kind, you've always got noisy neighbor problems, and that just sounds inherently difficult. Am I onto something there?
Oh, yes. I mean, because basically, like, the whole point of multi-tenancy also is that you might... you want to be able to share resource because it's cheaper, right? Sometimes you like you can spike and use some resource, use your cluster, and then somebody else, you know, maybe you during idle time somebody else using it. So when you basically go towards trying to save some, I guess, money, right? So that you pack your applications or user on a cluster, it means they're using the same resources. And in system like data systems, right? Like we know that any like Kafka or any actually like key value stores, any data systems, they're always kind of workload dependent, right? The performance is very dependent on what workload is doing. So there are many more things of like sharing resource, like how does workload impact that actual performance and so forth. So yes, it's very, very hard problem to solve.
What does it look like this just out of my curiosity, from like an API perspective, I mean, there isn't the relevant APIs don't have like a tenant ID. So what does it look like? Does a multi-tenant cluster look like here is an isolated set of Bootstrap servers that operationally happen to be all on the same cluster? I mean, how do I know as a developer that I am doing multi-tenancy? What do I do?
Oh, right. Yeah, so in Kafka, like I want to compare Kafka and maybe a few systems, right? So in Kafka, right, so there are ways to protect your data. So you can set authentication in encryption, and then you can set ACLs on topic. So you kind of, in that case, you kind of not consider yourself, like, it's not a tenant ID that you're setting. You just like, what's the data I'm accessing, and you're setting up protection in terms of authentication encryption. But for performance, that's kind of Kafka chose that approach, kind of separate the way you protect data and protect performance, right?
Gotcha.
So you are basically separating that from a Kafka perspective. The way you protect performance, your tenant is essentially your authenticated user or client. So basically, there are lots of ways to set it, right? You can just set on client IDs, your basically performance, what we call quotas, or you can set on your user. But the quotas, the way you protect performance, you are setting it from the application perspective, or like a set of clients that you want to bundle and say this is a tenant. And so, like, just to give an example, like the other way to do, like some systems do it as you kind of, and it go into that first use case of a virtual cluster, right? If you could set, like, say you have a unit, which is administrative unit of a tenant, where you both kind of providing some grouping of, like, say topic, like a namespace, and that namespace would also have performance set, like, say, okay, my set of topics would not be able, you would not be able to produce like more than 100 megabytes of the topic. So that's kind of like more tied in. In some ways, it's much easier, I would say. Like, I'm obviously right, less like you said one thing and this is whole thing, like one tenant, both data and both performance. But in Kafka, in a way, it's a bit harder, right? Because we don't have a, like, if you read our documents, we don't say word tenant. But in reality, you kind of logically defining it by setting, you know, your data protection, and then you say, okay, that application, for example, like take your application, if it's authenticated, it's identified by a user principle, and that's when you're setting your quotas to protect performance on a user principle. And there are ways you can set it like for one user or for, you know, user and client. Like, for example, you can even say one application and maybe it has whatever, right, like application is more like a, from, I guess, a high level thing that you can set, like even run multiple consumer groups. You can even separate performance of consumer groups by setting multiple tenants. So in Kafka, pretty much, if you say tenant from performance perspective, it is a authenticated user.
Got it. So you can group authenticated users into, you know, some sort of concept of tenancy. Potentially, you could have some set of, you know, these 15 principles are one tenant, and or you could have one principal is one tenant, just depending
yes.
on the scenarios you laid out before, where you might have some data you want to share, you might have no data you want to share, but through authentication, you're completely protected, and one
yes.
of those tenants is not able to see the other tenant's data.
Yes, exactly. But you're kind of setting it separately in a way. So it's in a way that it's kind of like one reason, you know, like maybe it's not sometimes, like, you know, in our documentation, it's not coming directly, right? That you actually can have, there are tenants, we just, they're pretty much users, or you can, you know, bundle those clients into that tenant.
Got it. So I guess before we get too far, I think we've talked about all these things, but mm-hmm. tell me again the things that it means for a system like Kafka to support multi-tenancy. Like, we've talked about isolating data and isolating performance, but just take us through the whole thing.
Yeah, so that's pretty much like everything to do with like protecting data, protecting performance. So for data, of course, there are something that's absolutely required and something that are good to have, right? So absolutely required, I would say, is authentication, is to be able to, you know, protect data both in flight and at rest. And like, for example, in Kafka, that would be setting like encryption, you know, using SSL and then using ACLs on topic. on topics. Other thing that usually are kind of good to have, but actually that's what Kafka doesn't have, which maybe it's a good thing to have, is it's namespacing, but really just about so that there is no collisions on topic names. So it is possible that you know, one team would set, you know, create a topic that some other team can create. So in that case, there is some workarounds to try to enforce naming conventions. So that would be nice. But it's not, yeah, it's kind of like, it making it a little bit harder, I guess, to build all this tooling. So that's one thing, right, for a data part. And then for performance part, obviously there are many, many things, the way how they do it, you know, the systems, but in general is how do you able to protect performance on a tenant, right? Like, can you set certain, like, can you achieve certain service level objective, meaning that, like, can my tenant get specific bandwidth or latency? And there are many, many ways, right? So actually, often there is a big range of things, like how good your multi-tenancy is, right? You can just say, oh, I want to be able to survive noisy neighbors, meaning that maybe that one application just runs and take over the whole cluster and causes maybe downtime, right? So that's like one side, like, you know, just kind of get some performance. Or there could be all way into like, okay, I have my objectives on performance, like in Kafka, right? In applications, usually have some expectation requirements, like say on bandwidth, right? How much data I can produce and how much I can consume. And that this whole way of like, what does it take for me to be able to achieve that? And so like in Kafka, you have quota mechanisms that you need to set to be able to achieve this kind of performance protection.
And I was hoping you'd bring those up. I was going to, if you mm-hmm. didn't, but as it turns out, I'm perfectly willing to admit this on the air. I know almost nothing about quotas in Kafka. This is just one of those things that has never, it just hasn't been a thing I've had to do or teach or explain or anything. So I would love it for my own sake. And if you're listening, I'm guessing some of you would also like to know more about this. Take it from the beginning, because it sounds like that's a key. I mean, like authentication and ACLs, we basically understand. Probably everybody has the basics there. And I get how you're describing that as a part of multi-tenant strategy. Naming conventions for topics is where you go for namespacing. It's easy enough to impose those if you control the clients, and you'd better control the clients. But quotas seem really important. Tell us about quotas.
Yes, so quotas is basically a limit, right? So in Kafka, the way you protect performance is you set a set of quotas. And in Kafka, you have a few kinds of quotas, like bandwidth quotas and what we call request quotas. And so I think usually people are, you know, there is better understanding what bandwidth quotas means. Right, because it's kind of more directly translate, like, oh, you know, as an application, you kind of understand what bandwidth is. So, for example,
sure, like, and like our phone plans, and sometimes our home internet provider, and everybody's bumped into a bandwidth quota.
Yeah, before, exactly.
Transfer quota, so, at least. Yeah.
Yeah, so those are kind of better understood, and maybe like I will start, and basically that's also always a good approach to start with them, and people do because, right, and in that case, I think it's. What I want to say about quotas first, right? So quotas are limits. So pretty much when you're setting quotas, you're pretty much saying that my application, you kind of tell the brokers or Kafka cluster, you know, start limiting my usage if I exceed it. So like say if I set 100 megabyte produce quota for bandwidth, then, you know, you kind of like set it up and then broker will start throttling you if you start exceeding it. So it's something that as an application or whatever tenant, you know, define, you set it. So which means that if you are just by yourself setting it and there are other tenants not setting it, right? Like you basically say, I'm a good neighbor, you know, you will limit my usage. But it means that if you really want that you are yourself protected, every other tenant should also set their quotas, because they should protect itself. So it's kind of a collective action that you're setting quotas for everybody, and then it means that everybody not be able to overrun and overuse resources. Good thing is like, yeah, that it somewhat sounds a little bit that, oh, you know, like, so operator have to know about every application, right? Or like how do I know? So in that case, you do have like default quotas in Kafka that you can just set and make sure that, you know, if somebody just deploy application without thinking what the quota should be, they will just get into default. So that's one thing. I think most important that when you think of quotas, it's really about not that you telling Kafka that I must have this bandwidth or provide me this bandwidth. It's more about that you're telling that limit me if I start using more because I want to be a good neighbor.
Got it.
Yeah. So that's one thing, right? So bandwidth and people, I noticed, people usually use it because, you know, you're kind of thinking like, okay, what my application needs, and you set it, you know, whatever it needs or some peak, usually peaks, right? Because if you set a quota, you never get more than that. So you kind of need to think of your peaks and you're setting it. But the other part, which I feel like I would say people don't really, it's not, I would say, easy. And also I don't see, like talking to customers and just like, you know, observing how people use quotas. Usually people stop with that, like with bandwidth, and kind of makes sense sometimes because bandwidth, most often like in Kafka clusters or many data systems, you kind of bottleneck, say on disk, right? So, you know, you often like, that's kind of when you also can overload. But there are cases actually, right? Because in a system like say Kafka brokers, they also process your requests. So you also take some CPU. But in many cases, right, if you especially have very, you know, lots of cores on each broker, you might not even notice, right? You might have some utilization of CPU, but it's not a big deal. Maybe your workloads are not very efficient, but it's still kind of enough. But in some cases, it's still useful, right? So like it is possible to actually overload on CPU. And when you're using lots of CPU, like when you start getting into very high utilization on broker, your bandwidth, effective bandwidth, what cluster can give you, start decreasing. And so for that situation, you do actually want to set what we have in Kafka called request quotas. It's really your way to limit usage of CPU on a cluster, just in case when you have like very inefficient workloads, inefficient meaning like you're creating lots of connections and like, for example, encryption is quite CPU heavy, or you have very small requests when they like brokers do lots of CPU processing. So you're kind of pretty much protecting both yourself and everybody else to the case when, you know, your workload just takes so much CPU that broker becomes just mostly processing stuff without doing what we would call like useful work, which is delivering your bandwidth. So I would always kind of say that, like, advise everybody to look into request quotas because this is where you also protect CPU.
So you've got bandwidth quotas, and they're really for I/O bound things, specifically disk I/O bound problems. Okay.
Yes, and normally even, you know, like say, of course, in Kafka, right, like often we do write to cache, right? So like if in some way you think, oh, why is it this? But like if you think of like sustained bandwidth, right? So at some point you need to start like, you know, like Linux would be like flashing to disk. So in reality, and in many system disks, like kind of a bottleneck, right? So like which resource you run out first? And right. Very often you run out of disk bandwidth, like EBS, right? Like, I mean, obviously disk is generic disk, right? Could be sure. Like anything. Yeah.
Disk with a little TM next to it, you know, it's a disk-like thing, which may actually be a network connection. There's a disk there at some point. We're relatively sure there's a disk somewhere. And the API that we see is definitely a disk API. So that's bandwidth is to protect disk, and requests are to protect CPU. And are those the quota options we have, or any other options?
So those are like main options. There is one thing which I would say, and although it's not actually still in, this is something in progress that is what we call connection rate limits, but they're not necessarily quota, because when we talk about quotas, right, they're per tenant, like which is basically user in a Kafka world. But the problem, right, when we protect CPU, the way quotas, those quotas work in Kafka, they protect by throttling requests. And so it's actually in, it's still like those request quota that takes into account, like say encryption authentication. So if tenant does more of this, it's pretty much what now throttle requests to basically give space to like, you know, doing connections. But at some point, right, like broker, like throttling requests is not enough, right? Because you can just have like, you know, if you have misconfigured client, you can make a connection storm, which bring down the brokers. So for that reason, we are putting what we call connection rate limits, which are to ensure that Kafka does not accept connections, right? Because to be able, like, you basically to limit how much you spend on authentication or creating connections, you need to limit that you don't accept connections. So that's what coming in 2.6. Oh, sorry, put 2.7.
Yeah. There's a couple of KIPs, and I can't remember the KIP numbers. Maybe you can.
Yes. So what I'm talking about is KIP 612. Although I would say it's only half of KIP there. So what's coming in 2.7 is protecting a broker or I guess a listener, because you can have multiple listeners.
Right,
so that's pretty
right.
much kind of a protection of the broker, which is also useful, I guess, useful. Some it doesn't mean that it still means that your tenant, you know, like say you have some clients which causing storms, right? It can take over that whole whatever allowance that broker has. So we're putting limits also on per IP, and that would come, I guess, I would say in the next release. And the issue is like, why? My question is like, oh, why is it not per user? It's because, you know, at the point when you accept connections, you don't know which user it is, right? Because you need to authenticate to know what it, who that is. So that's why it's like, it's a little bit harder, not harder, but it's a bit different problem that you're solving. So
right. And yeah. Just so everybody knows, it's October 28th when we're recording this, and this will probably release a few weeks from now. But 2.7 is supposed to drop about a week from now. And of course, tests run and the PMC has to vote and everything. And there's a process around all this. So anything could happen. Maybe by the time this podcast is released, it still won't be there. But KIP 612 is supposed to be a part of 2.7. And I happen to have this on the front of my mind right now because about 25 hours before right now, I was next to a little stream near my house recording the release video for 2.7 and talking about KIP 612. So this is all fresh in my mind.
Oh, actually, oh, there is one more KIP. It's important, but it's a bit different, right? So it's KIP 599. I don't know if you talked about it. Hopefully you did, right? So this is slightly different because everything I talked about, all these like connections and you know, protecting CPU and bandwidth, it's kind of more like request path, right? So, but there is another part, KIP 599, it allows you to set limits or quotas also per user, basically per tenant, on what we call partition mutation.
Yes.
What it means is actually just like, you know, when basically it's like creating, deleting partitions, meaning that like if you create a topic, it will create partitions, or you delete a topic, deleting partitions, or you like expanding the topic, like adding partitions. So all that kind of operation on creating or deleting partition, that's what we call mutation. And why it's important is, so it's not something that like, right, it's like not usually like you create topics, it's not that like you do it every second or every time, but it's usually useful, like at least we've seen cases with customers when, you know, if you start like somehow you created a very large topic or set of topics, meaning like it will be thousands of partitions. And before KIP 599, you can actually, right, you make controller very busy, and controller is something that you don't want to make too busy because it does take care of like, you know, leader and ISR and everything, right? So we've seen cases when if somebody tries to create a very large number of partitions, it basically just kind of brings the whole cluster like not down but super slow. And especially if you end up like getting into undeprecated partitions, right, to be able to recover, your controller need to be able to send all this leader and ISR requests. It's busy to creating topics, obviously. It's becoming a mess. So it's very hard to control. So KIP 599 really like kind of protects from the case when somebody just creates a large topic and then the whole thing is just going pretty bad around that time.
Got it. Yeah, so those are like above and beyond just extra protections for brokers. And that is at the broker level. But did you say, and I just summarized these yesterday, but there's a way to do it per source IP, and these are broker level configs, right? Is there any
so, Oh, yes. So for connection rate, yeah, it's only pretty much broker level listener, because you can set different listeners, listener level or per IP. And so that's only relates to connection rate, because, you know, at the point when you want to be able to reject connections or not accept them or, like, you know, delay it, it is before you know who the user is. But like for partition quotas, those are actually still per user. So the same kind of tenant definition as we use for like request and bandwidth quotas.
Gotcha. So, I mean, you've been working on this. Talk about what's been hard, because it seems performance isolation seems really hard when applications are sharing the same physical resources. So how do you measure that? Like, what are the actual SLOs that you specifically look at? And then how do you do that? I mean, I'm just thinking, obviously I know a lot less about the internals than you do, but I'm just wondering, how would you even try? So
yeah. So basically I would say, like, there are two different answers, right? Because I mostly, my work is in Confluent Cloud, and we kind of slightly, I guess, ahead, you know, what in Kafka, and we would be moving some of the work we did to Confluent platform. And really the hard part actually, right, when you, like, consider first, you know, when you have a single tenant case, right, like without any quotas or multi-tenancy, you know, when you deploy your cluster, like you have to have some kind of capacity planning, right? Like you always answer question, you know, whatever applications I'm running, is that cluster be able to, you know, provide me with bandwidth that I need? But now imagine that you have multi-tenancy, right? So when you set quotas, you can set, like, you set them, but there is like Kafka allows you to set, like, it doesn't actually check what the capacity is. So basically Apache Kafka, what we had, is does not have a notion inside, like in brokers, like what's my capacity? Am I getting overloaded? So the hard part about this, you know, when you just use quotas, it's a bit quite some iterative approach you need to be taking, and somebody, you know, to kind of understand, do I have enough capacity so that all the neighbors, you know, noisy neighbor, like or tenants who set those quotas, you know, actually have a capacity. And so, you know, I would say, like, normally that's kind of lots of, I would say, like, manual work, meaning that, you know, you try to deploy this application, is it not enough capacity, you need to expand, or, you know, make sure that your cluster is big enough. And so that's a lot of work we are doing in around Confluent Cloud, where obviously we cannot, like, we don't know who is going to use, you know, our cluster. Can they just use more, or is it enough? So it's lots of work around putting notion in, like, that mechanisms or indicators inside broker, so they know when they kind of exceed capacity or like they approaching what they can do. And then what called auto tuning, because we recognize that it's true that in Kafka you have to set all these quotas, and those are kind of a configuration manual, right? And something changes, you again manually have to go and change them. So the work we are doing is, how do we have all those quotas, but without, you know, you setting and config. So, for example, like for request quotas, right, you can set, okay, give me some, like, for, it's very hard, like, we do, you know, I have that, gave this talk in Kafka Summit, right? It's basically the whole talk, like, if you want performance objectives, how do you get, how do you set quotas? But again, you would notice that it would require some iteration, your own, like, kind of like capacity planning. And so for some of these quotas, like request quotas, it's not even clear when you reach, right, what the capacity is, because again, like as I said, this bandwidth, right, it's all dependent of how those resources interact, right? So like if you use too much CPU, your bandwidth of the whole cluster can go down. So you need to be able to, for brokers at least as a minimum, to recognize that. And if you like say, now when you have the case when you, now all the tenants try to use more resources than it has, at least we can dynamically lower the quotas and make sure that we don't overload the cluster, and then use it, you know, because you can have metrics saying, and we do have metrics actually in Apache, right? Also that, like, are we throttling or not? Like when quotas get met or exceeded, they start throttling. And so those kind of metrics, when we know that it gets throttled, it kind of indicates that we need to expand. So a lot of this work comes to like understanding like in brokers to be able to dynamically detect when there's not enough capacity, change quotas, and kind of having us auto-scaling, auto-expansion going on. So that's pretty much kind of like the direction, at least to be able to, how do we set it up, but also in cases when you cannot afford, we cannot run like, people behind the scenes and just like evaluating your capacity. So that's kind of hard problem that we are solving.
Because it has to be automated, or at least automated to some degree.
Yes, yes. And I feel like it's kind of like could be at the point useful also, even not on the cloud, because right, anything that makes it easier to operate is always better. But making it easier specifically for quotas is not easy, right? Because you need to like be able to do like good algorithms, right? For example, to be able to detect capacity, we kind of have indicators like on latency, like how much does broker get overloaded, and are those indicators good or not, right? Like how well you do. It also defines how, what's your SLA, and also what's your, it's actually all, basically quotas is really performance management is really like you trying to trade off, right? Because you can always over-provision and you don't need to worry about things. But in reality, you don't want to over-provision. You want to run as close to the capacity as possible. And that's when it becomes harder because now you need to be careful because you get the risk of, even losing your SLA. Basically, you get the risk of downtime if you overuse it. And so that's kind of the problem that we want to be able to not over-reserve and still protect the cluster from, just all the tenants suddenly using more resources than we actually have in physical. And then potentially auto-scaling means that we automatically add those resources when they need it.
Got it. Because you do... if you have super sophisticated auto scaling, which is we don't have yet, right? But if you had that, then you could get away without over provisioning. But it strikes me that no matter what, like you said, you don't just want to over provision. I mean, if it were that simple, it'd be like, okay, let's provision 4x the amount of resources we need, and we'll probably be okay. But you're paying for that. Compute and storage cost money, and so, like any engineer, you're trying to optimize, get the most work done with the least valuable resources possible. And so you don't want to over-provision, but you kind of have to when you're trying to isolate performance, right? I mean, is there any amount of magical auto-scaling that could ever get the job done fast enough? Do you always have to over-provision a little?
I don't know if you have to, but it's nice to have some headroom, but you never know how much, right? Like, especially, it's more relevant to cloud case if you like want to really like, for example, in our case, when people use cloud, especially it's a usage-based billing, right? So like you can just have your cluster sitting idle. So you, as a tenant, right? You can admit lots of tenants so they can all spike at the same time. So the thing is really not about that. Yes, the auto scaling takes time, so it's not that like instant. And so when you cannot really go around the case when if you don't have enough physical resource, it's not a like it's pretty much there's no magic. You don't have a resource, there's nothing you can do. But what we're doing instead, right? So in normal case, without like say what we are doing. If you spike, you start overloading. Basically, you can actually get to underprivileged partitions, or you can basically bring the whole cluster down with too much load, right? So our approach is that you need to protect that load. So basically to protect that, the total combined usage is at the level that brokers can support, and then you expand. So there is some case when you actually might not get all the resources from the cluster, but it's more about that you don't kill the cluster, right?
Right. Maybe it doesn't go down.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of temporary, maybe down, maybe performance slightly decreases for you temporary, but it doesn't completely like kill the whole thing. But it's true. Like, I mean, I don't think anybody can actually solve the problem. Like, you know, if you don't have capacity, you don't have it. And the other way, like we're kind of considering, and maybe that's people also bring it up that, yeah, it's possible also to implement some kind of priorities, right? Who, you know, whenever that happens, when cluster suddenly you don't have enough resource, you know, maybe, you know, for some applications you really need to deliver it, but for some maybe don't, and kind of a little bit of prioritization, which we actually don't have in Kafka and not in cloud yet, but this is something that is it's a kind of known approaches, like how do you prioritize up to some degree, right? So you can also, we can add that, and that at least would ensure that if you don't have enough resource, who is getting it? Because right now we kind of like, you know, everybody is equal, like they would all equally get a little bit less, but you might not want to be equal.
Right. You might want, say, requests to win over bandwidth, or bandwidth to win over requests, or one tenant to win over another, or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Because, yeah, basically, like I would say, because I did work, like this is a kind of like performance management and like guarantees on performance, something that I work like for at least 15 years. And for example, like I did actually write my PhD topic was about hard and soft real-time guarantees on disk performance and then storage, right? So basically, you know, it's always like if you want any hard or some kind of guarantees, it is always about keeping some resource reservation. So you cannot basically have both. You either over-provision and kind of assume certain worst case and have it, or like in real, like more kind of production systems, often you kind of just want to be able to deal with the case when you don't have that capacity, how to quickly get there and how to make sure that, you know, it's the downgrade, whatever impact is minimal and more fair among all the tenants.
Right. So in other words, it costs something to hold the resource, but it also costs something to get the resource, which is
exactly
the transaction cost problem rearing its head again, which it, you know, everything seems to be about transaction costs. So that's
yeah, exactly. Because like systems, like I would say more like real-time system, like real-time meaning not real-time like we use in Kafka, but actual real-time, like, you know, satellites and stuff.
Yeah, hard real-time.
Like hard real-time firmware, right? So those are like, you know, the way you get it, it's pretty much you have what we call like admission control, which meaning that you cannot even admit application if there is not a resource. But obviously, like in Kafka, like, do we really want to do that? Probably not. So it's more about we admit everything, but then we kind of have a way to, like, you know, what to do when we have the problem. So maybe that other way to see it.
Yeah. Good analogy. Cause I did real-time stuff early in my career. I wrote firmware and, you know, you'll get, There'll be some sort of like memory allocation API. It was all C back in the 90s. And I guess a lot of it is still, but you don't have malloc, right? There's no heap. That's just not a thing. You have pre-allocated buffer pools. Here is a chunk of stuff. Here's our resources. And we'll divvy it out to you a piece at a time. But it is, and I guess heaps are sort of, in a sense, pre-allocated as well. But there's just an extra intentionality about reserving those resources so that they can be delivered at a predictable transaction cost, and, you know, you don't have to go spin up instances, because that's the kind of transaction cost we're talking about here, where that's clearly, well, you know, on a request basis, that's prohibitive.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I like saying when you say, like, it's true, like when they say, like, oh, it's hard to guarantee performance or hard to, like, provide certain kind of, like, SLOs. In reality, right, we're not really providing, like, we guarantee, like, it's always certain bandwidth or it's always certain latency. It's always kind of statistical thing. So 99 percentile is pretty good if you can get there. 95th percentile is much easier. So whatever, you know, higher on percentile you get is harder to get it. And at some point, you do have to start, like, leaving headrooms. So that's pretty much kind of the game you're playing.
Right. Well, that's just, that's, again, because there are transaction costs in the physical universe, and we are bound to them.
Yeah.
What happens when a client is bad? Let's not say bad. Let's not put a value judgment into it. But let's say what happens when a client has needs that we're not able to meet right now and violates a quota.
Yeah. So that's what we basically call, it gets throttled. So like in if it violates like bandwidth and request quotas, it gets throttled on requests. And what that means And actually, this is kind of like Kafka, we're like on second iteration of it. So Kafka before 2.0, it used to just, when a broker detects that, say, you used all your bandwidth, and to bring you back to quota, it would calculate delay, you know, how much you need to, you know, wait so that we can process it and bring you back to quota. And so we used to keep those requests in brokers and then delay the response. And that kind of didn't really work well, because especially when you have like, you have to set long delays, right? Like, how does client know if it's like, maybe that message is lost, right? Why is it response not coming back? And so since 2.0, what we did is broker still calculates delays. So it knows like, okay, you need to wait a bit longer for process next request to bring it back to your, say, bandwidth. And so it sends that delay in the response back to client, and an internal Kafka client, right? It knows how to deal with it, starting from 2.0. And they would be, what they do is just delaying sending the next request on the same channel. And of course, we can still have old clients, and in that case, broker also mutes the channel from that client. So basically, not gonna read any more requests until the delay passes. So that's kind of, yeah. So that's pretty much the thing. The throttling actually happens on the client side, so that you don't keep, right, because like clients need to have some idea, you know, what's going on. And then of course we also have metrics, so you can always observe, right? So like we have client and both client and broker metrics, so you can see if throttling happening.
And see if you're encroaching on quotas and
yes, because often you might want to, like, I think normally, like, if you actually do, I think it's useful to observe this metrics, because maybe it means that maybe your application now wants to increase like usage, right? Maybe adoption increases of your application, right? So often you might want to then expand cluster, increase your quota. So it's kind of useful to know that, you know, now you reached what you thought you need, I think. Yeah.
This is another, it seems like yet another way in which we see clients carry a lot of weight in Kafka. I mean, we try so hard to keep brokers simple and we're like mostly winning that fight. And there's a lot of stuff gets pushed into clients. It's I think a sign of good architecture, but I'm constantly exposed to some new thing I didn't know clients do.
Right. Yes. But at least because you do, in any case, you do need some kind of way to communicate, right, to client, like why, right? Because you can just lose the request. And the problem was before, like,
right, retry.
let me retry. And then basically your cluster already kind of like, you know, struggling because, you know, you're using a lot and suddenly you get all these new requests for no reason. So that was actually often kind of did opposite effect. So in those cases, it's really useful when it's on the client side, or at least for the, you know, for everybody else using the brokers.
My guest today has been Dr. Anna Povsner. Anna, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you, team.
Hey, you know what you get for listening to the end? Some free Confluent Cloud. Use the promo code 60PDCAST. That's 60PDCAST to get an additional $60 of free Confluent Cloud usage. Be sure to activate it by December 31st, 2021, and use it within 90 days after activation. And any unused promo value on the expiration date will be forfeit, and there are a limited number of codes available, so don't miss out. Anyway, as always, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in our community Slack. There's a Slack signup link in the show notes if you'd like to join. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover us, which we think is a good thing. So thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.